You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, the Course for Speakers to Promote the Idea of Threefolding. Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 2, given in Stuttgart on February 13, 1921, in the afternoon. As of right now, we will move forward only if we are able to provide a satisfactory basis, meaning one that is illuminating for people, for what will heal present-day civilization. And in regard to the various questions before us, much depends on whether we begin with a valid starting point. First, a healthy understanding must be communicated of the actual reasoning behind the kinds of statements found in Toward Social Renewal, and everything connected with them. This is simultaneously a matter of social relationships and the formation of socially oriented judgments. When exploring these sorts of judgments, we are always dealing with the following. If you make judgments about actual relationships only on the basis of logical reasoning, relationships that involve people's feelings and will forces, since this is, of course, always the case when it comes to social relationships, then you will only come up with never-ending debates. This must also be kept in mind during discussions. When it comes to the unstable reality in which human beings participate, you must take experience as your starting place, a particular experience of one sort or another, rather than logical reasoning, because it is always possible to say a lot both for and against anything that you might consider. Only from the perspective of experience is it possible to make a judgment about something. The reason that so many different and contradictory socio-political perspectives have emerged recently is that the people who proposed them did not take experience, the observation of relationships, as their starting place, and did not form their judgments on the basis of it. This is, in fact, exactly what was attempted in a comprehensive way in Title Toward Social Renewal. And we must make it intelligible to others that everything found at present in science and education has no foundation for these sorts of judgments, apart from the one found in anthroposophical spiritual science, which does not take logical reasoning alone as its basis, but rather begins in comprehensive experience. And in our spiritual science, you nurture in yourself the capacity to judge on the basis of experience, whereas the way that contemporary scientists beat the drum of experience is only posturing. Contemporary science speaks a lot about experience, but makes its judgments solely on the basis of purely abstract intellectualism. Our spiritual science does not do that. In that way, it fundamentally nurtures the capacity to judge on the basis of experience. You see, the man I recently mentioned in a public lecture, the national economist Terhala, quoted a statement by someone not particularly authoritative in these matters, Georg Brandes, who said that it is so hard to do the right thing in social relationships, because the vast majority of people do not make logical judgments, but act out of instinct. It is easy to have the impression, if you believe that you stand on a certain infallible basis in all of your decisions, that everything occurring in the soul of a social group comes out of instinct and not out of reason. In a certain sense, it is even correct to say this. But it really does not get you anywhere. If, when considering the formation of judgments, you consider groups of people, whether nationalities or classes, rather than individuals, it is never possible for a judgment to arise from reason. The things that form a judgment do not come solely from convergences in what people think, but also out of what they feel and want. Thus a one-dimensional judgment can never exist, absolutely never. From the standpoint of reason, there are no unambiguous social judgments. Social judgments can only be made with a perspective on their representational quality. This is not something you can say to people without further explanation, because otherwise it will be misunderstood. But in our times, you must know that when a person intends to develop and deliver a social judgment, this act is possible only if there is some recognition of its representational quality, which is to say, that a judgment allows itself to be bent and formed, that it very much has a kind of artistic structure, though the word is frowned upon, and not merely a logical structure. Only those judgments that have this kind of malleable form can be applied to social life. This is something that I had to say in order to give our intended subject its proper direction. In addition, it is necessary these days to accustom people to having a certain breadth of horizon. We are worlds away from those who make judgments by looking at the smallest possible horizon, and then hold to those judgments with the belief that they are absolute, are infallibly correct. They see only what is directly in front of them, but they make judgments about everything. This is the character of our age. From this you will see that in the case of everything that I have attempted to present, this was true even earlier, since April 1919, I did not strive to offer finished judgments, but rather to demonstrate certain things that would allow individuals to make judgments of their own. Ever since April 1919, my striving has been toward the creation of a basis for independent judgments made by each individual. This, too, is something that you should make clear to all circles of the world, that we do not dispense finished dogmatic judgments, but rather offer guidance that sets the individual on a path that enables independent judgment. And you will improve your effectiveness, your speaking, by not setting much store in finished dogmatic judgments. Rather, your primary task, above all else, must be to see to the creation of a basis upon which one person will arrive at a judgment by one means, another person by another. Only when there is a convergence of these sorts of judgments will we have something that we can actually use in reality. It is unfortunately all too true that the world is full of judgments, and it is equally true that the world is far from having the foundations for the formation of proper judgments. And now I come to a point that I would like to use as a preface to our considerations here, a point that absolutely must be clear to you, and that you must use as a starting point for the development of your talks, rather than simply repeating to others word for word what I am saying to you now. When developing your talks, you must begin with an awareness of what I will now attempt to present to you. You see, within European civilization, in the course of the last 100, 150, 170 years, a vast diversity of judgments, the broadest variety of unrest, has appeared in all areas of social life. Try for a moment to take an overview of everything that the 19th century brought to us in the way of perspectives on social life. And you see, if you really go through all of them, that actually every single one of these attempts always has several weak points. You will see in every case that a true overview of what is necessary cannot be found. The people who assessed and discussed social life during that period of time brought forward many shrewd observations, many exceptionally shrewd ones. But it was always the case that they finally had to admit all of that really does not have much effect on reality. You really cannot do anything with the things that national economists and practitioners have presented about one social institution or another. It was possible to do something with them in some small area, but never on a comprehensive scale. And the reason lies in the fact that for almost 200 years, people have tried to, in quotes, resolve questions within Europe on the basis of rudimentary foundations. At least they believed they were solving them on this basis, problems that cannot be resolved in this way. I would like to use the following comparison in order to make what I am trying to say understandable. If a man is building a house and the foundation and the basement are finished, it is not possible for him to decide that he now wants an entirely new building plan for the second and third stories of the house. He must continue to build according to the plans that he was using when he built the foundation and the ground floor. Once something is already underway, you cannot make something entirely new and unrelated out of the foundation you have laid. This, however, is exactly what happened in Europe. National economists, socialist activists, bourgeois agitators, practitioners, and others wanted to resolve economic and legal questions, but in actuality all of their so-called solutions were built in the air. But it was not possible simply to go back and start from the fundamentals either. If we really take into consideration the whole life of civilization, a life that is increasingly a whole from which it is impossible to extract individual parts, one can only say, quote, "Yes, in truth, we live in the midst of an ongoing evolution," close quote. We cannot ask ourselves at this point, what are the primary fundamentals of legal relationships in the civilized world? What are the primary fundamentals of economic relationships in the civilized world? This is something that people of our time always forget to bear in mind. Things are rather curious in Switzerland, for example. The belief is that it is possible to consider distinctly, quote, Swiss affairs, close quote, separate from those of the rest of the world, and then to think about legal and economic affairs in that bubble. This is what people there have done for more than 200 years. And this is the fundamental reason why such chaos has now arrived. You see, people tried to resolve, I always have to say resolve with quotation marks, questions that, to make use of my earlier comparison, had already been built up to the ground floor by the 18th century. You can only build the next story of that building on top of what has already been built. This all goes back to the fact that within European civilization, people have lost the ability to have a proper feeling for historical experiences, particularly for those historical experiences that have laid the foundations for the life that springs forth from them. And the most important historical experiences must be properly judged if one intends to make judgments later. You cannot always make judgments by going back to the fundamentals. And by that, I am pointing toward two important experiences that, although they lie in the distant past, must now be carefully considered. Our spiritual life, as well as our rights political life, as well as our economic life in Europe, are based on such experiences. And you cannot think about modern civilization unless you are clear about what was brought into Europe by these occurrences. The first of these is from 1721. It is the Treaty of Nystad that ended the Great Northern War. The second is from 1763, the Treaty of Paris, which brought an end to the conflict between France and the North American colonies and England. These two occurrences are, actually, in the world of factual reality, very much part of the life of European civilization. You can see their effects everywhere. But Europeans have completely forgotten to think about these events in the correct way. As a result, they all make incorrect assessments constantly. The facts that I have presented to you are hidden within all of them. I would put it this way. The way we eat breakfast every morning has come about as a result of these events. But people do not want to know about it, just as they do not want to know anything about reality, but want only to make judgments with their heads and logically set their heads spinning. I mean that literally. Most of the judgments that are made now really do put a spin on things, in the colloquial sense of the word. You see, if you appraise these two events properly, you will have to see a connection between both of them and the European catastrophe in which we now find ourselves. In human evolution, it is not the case that you can make a judgment about something over the course of a few years, because facts and occurrences stretch themselves over vast periods of time. The matter stands as follows. In 1721, in the Treaty of Neustadt, it was first decided that Russia was a power in spiritual life, as well as Reich's political life, as well as economic life, one that had a hold in European affairs. Now, this is of no small significance, because Russia, in regard to its spiritual constitution, I say this not to insult, but to present the reality of the matter. Russia, as far as its spiritual interests are concerned, is to this day an Asian power, a power with an Eastern morality. Its soul life is in a form that is familiar to us only through its similarity to the Eastern soul life. Inserted into this Eastern soul life is an exception, that which was brought about by Peter the Great, which in turn led Russia to expand into the Baltic Sea region. With that, all later things were already decided, and this too is something characteristic. Europe had discussed whether Russia should come to Constantinople or not, and this question was decided in 1721 at the Treaty of Neustadt. And this is one of the essential characteristics of European discussions, that people are always trying to answer questions that have already been more or less resolved. The question was already answered to a certain extent back then, and yet people continue to start over without paying attention to the fact that these things happened. What did this bring about? If you consider the whole history of Europe and the division of Russia in the 19th century in relation to it, then you will have to say to yourself, quote, "This division of Russia," close quote. Just think about the Pan-Slavic and Slavic movements, continue, quote, "This division of Russia led necessarily to the spiritual questions of European life taking an Eastern turn," close quote. Rome, for example, had to capitulate to the East to a certain extent. The East wanted to retain the constitution of its soul. Thus, Eastern Catholicism divided from Roman Catholicism. This is a wholly different world in regard to soul constitution. It is, above all, a world in which there has always been a tendency to blend the things that come forward in spiritual life with those that are part of the worldly, secular, governmental regime. There was, to some extent, a desire to seek religious leadership in the state leadership. So it was through this that European civilization's relationship to the East arrived at its current configuration. Questions were raised that did truly exist, meaning not the ones that have been dreamt up and about which so many people have given in to illusions. Simply consider the constant stance the Czech Slavs and the Southern Slavs had toward Russia, to which Russia responded with something that, of course, was in the external realm of political power, nothing more than an empty phrase, but that still had an incredibly misleading effect on the hearts of the Russian people: freedom for the people of the Balkans. Everywhere there are spiritual forces, into the mix come other things that are again part of spiritual national relationships: the antagonism between the Polish-Slavic element and the Russian element. Thus the entire situation of Eastern Europe is defined. And everything that was reflected there in the spiritual realm is dependent upon the life of the collective civilization. It is not possible to speak about the things that play out in human evolution if one looks only at a part of the story. You cannot simply say that there is, generally speaking, a perspective on how the spiritual life, the economic life, and the Reich's political life should stand in relation to one another. One can speak about these questions only by considering certain actual conditions. And the way in which Eastern spiritual life affected things, transplanted as it was into Europe, is wholly dependent on the fact that Russia is largely an agrarian empire that has not fully come to an end, that conditions there still lead people to say, quote, "Nature provides people with everything that they need," close quote, Such a soul constitution, as it came over from the East into European life, is necessarily dependent on the things that were made possible by the agrarian lifestyle in Russia. The individual Russian man, regardless of which class he belonged to, would not have the soul constitution that he has if his external daily life were not so intimately connected with the natural world. For the whole of Eastern life, a true question of economics, and thereby the third branch of the threefold social organism, is simply not present. Everywhere, all over the world, there are these three branches of human social life: the spiritual life, the rights political life, and the economic life. But the soul constitution of the people, under the influence of these three branches, always expresses itself differently, according to whether those in question are inclined to look toward all that the land offers, or whether they are not inclined to look to all that the land offers. The farther we go toward the East, the more self-evident it becomes that people make use of the natural world and cull from it the things that it offers up. And in this way they have economic activity without doing much to organize an economic life as such. And the situation in Russia did not necessitate, or was not found to be necessary, the organization of an economic life as such. This comes out of an Eastern way of thinking. When it comes to these matters, the Eastern way of thinking expends as little effort as possible, if I may put it this way, to go beyond the perspective of another, in quotes, population on the earth. That population is, namely, the animal world. Anyone who believes that this animal world does not also have a spiritual life, and even to some extent a rights political life, that person is altogether on the wrong track. Animal life absolutely has a spiritual life and some form of rights life, but it does not have an economic life. It simply takes what is given to it by the natural world. And the Eastern population raises itself as little as possible above this earthly population, the animal world. The Eastern population has this distinct spiritual life, which follows the imagistic and the intuitive. Because in its economic life, it takes what the natural world offers and does not spend much time discussing that economic life. Everything that is part of the social structure there is established on the basis of things other than economic relationships, on the basis of class and of lineage, but not on economic thinking. This particular soul constitution, this is the precondition that allows one to give so much over to the nation-state element, as happens in the East. Europe has been discussing national and social questions for two centuries, but in regard to both matters, the discussion has been conducted on the basis of these two elements without taking into account the things that were really already there. One could simply no longer think about things as they were thought of in the 19th century, and especially in the second half of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, after the national element had been given the nuance with which it had been imbued through the influence of an Asian element, of the Slavic national element, as it had come to fruition. And so, people were actually talking about national questions anachronistically. The things they continued to discuss were long since over. People should have already been conscious of the fact that one day the big question might arise, whether the East and its way of thinking about spiritual life might be able to overpower the West. Even today, the first signs of this are showing. In the East, in Asia, discussions are taking place about how to make it happen, that all of the technical, scientific thought in Europe, with its abstractions and its exploitations and so on, disappears, allowing for a takeover by the Asian element of human feelings and sensations, what is associated with the soul. In the abstract, you might even be in agreement with this idea. But the fact of the matter is that the soul life and the spiritual life of the East are in a state of decadence. This does not contradict the idea that the forces of the future are in the Russian soul. But everything that was there is in a full-fledged state of decadence. You cannot count on anything resembling a solution coming over from the East. You see, through the Treaty of Neustadt in 1721, all of Europe came under the particular nuance of national thinking that had been thrust upon the Slavic nations. And all the results contaminated Europe to a certain extent. Europe was contaminated by Russia's ability to take part in its affairs. And the experimental nation, if you truly concern yourself with world affairs and do not simply stop at the borders of your own country, then you will see such things. The experimental nation in this case was Austria. And Austria failed because people there continued to have discussions about questions that to a certain extent had already been taken in a particular direction. Austria has not been able to come to terms with its Slavic problem because Austria could do so only if it had developed an understanding for its original productive spirit, for a spiritual life that came out of its own elements. It is true that you cannot talk about such a spiritual life to the liberals, for example, them least of all. They would only always respond, and in countries that are republics, this was always the response. These liberals would always say, quote, well, if we turn our schools over to a free spiritual life, then Catholicism will take over these schools, and we will have resigned ourselves to clericalism, close quote. This is their argument. But this argument is based on the idea that people will think that their only possibility is to appeal to a spiritual life that was productive centuries ago, but that is now anachronistic, decadent. In the moment that one becomes conscious of the need for a freely created spiritual life, then one finds it to be self-evident that this must, of course, be given to the life of our schools. Because people do not take part in the creation of civilization with their own will forces, but rather desire merely to give themselves over to something that feeds them, be it the state or a pre-made economic life, because they do not infuse their will with creative powers. Because of all this, damaged organizations like this will result. It is a matter of being able to free oneself without giving the schools over to an old way. The people who talk in the way that I have mentioned also say, but, quote, but we will not ever bring about a new spiritual life, and so the old one will simply overrun everything, close quote. In that case, you can easily become a follower of Spengler and his book, The Decline of the West. There it makes no difference whether we do anything at all, or whether the Catholic Church takes over everything. But a new spiritual life must be there. It was not wrong that at one time the church ran the schools, for everything that we now have in scientific life came about in one way or another from the old church. That the church ran the schools is not what is wrong. What is wrong is if the traditional church were again to run schools when, in fact, we are standing before the historical imperative to achieve a new spiritual life. So, it was only Europe's inability to imagine a new spiritual life that brought about the discussion of national questions. It would have been necessary from the perspective of productive spiritual life for Central Europe to have an effect on the East. This would certainly have frozen in their tracks all the things that came about in the pan-Slavic and Slavic movements. This spiritual life was there in its beginning stages. Around the turn of the 18th century, people had begun to create a new spiritual life, and it was called Goetheanism. But the people did not have the courage to hold to it. This is one side of the story. On the other side are the issues that people discuss and understand as social economic. Since 1763, ever since certain territories had to be given to England by France, thus deciding that North America would be Anglo-Saxon and not French and Spanish, the economic-social question has been directed down a very specific channel. There were many decisive moments in the 18th century. In the East, there was the 1721 Treaty of Nystadt, and in the West, there was the 1763 Treaty of Paris. These two important decisions, hidden within the whole spiritual and economic life of Europe, must be kept in mind, because you will never arrive at any judgments unless you do. And you see, you cannot make value judgments about the things that come up in world history, as so many people do, from entirely subjective perspectives. Sometimes you can do nothing other than make use of certain radical words and descriptions. The East had at one time a great and powerful primal wisdom. Today, it is the case that to some extent the East, with its decadent and old primal wisdom, has fallen into barbarism. For, in quotes, barbarism, in Schiller's sense of the word, is nothing more than the rationalization of primal human instincts, the directing of those instincts through understanding and mere thought life. If, however, we call the East barbaric, and speak of the barbarism in the East, and particularly in Russia, then the further west we move as we pass England and cross over into America, then, by the same token, this Western civilization must be called not civilization at all, but rather savagery. This is the opposite of barbarism. The barbarian tyrannizes the heart and the feelings with the head. The savage tyrannizes the head with all that comes from the rest of the human organism, with the life of instincts. And this, in essence, is the Western life. And this Western life is the site of savagery. If you look past the gilded layer of European culture that you find in America, you have to ask yourself, quote, what is the American culture at its core? Close quote. It is, to put it radically, savagery. But there is no chauvinistic agitation hiding in these words. If you truly want to recognize this American life for what it is, then you have to say, quote, the Europeans have not actually conquered the Native Americans there inwardly, externally, certainly, but inwardly the Europeans have immersed themselves in the Native American life. Instincts have become the ruler. Close quote. And this is what lies at the core, the altering of Europeans by Native American instincts. It is not only the case that the Europeans, after they have lived over there for a while, have longer arms and so on, this has been anthropologically confirmed, the constitution of the soul is also changed. It is not a matter of what people have as concepts and mental pictures, but rather what, as a whole, human being, they possess as their constitution. And in that regard, one has to say that the farther west one moves, the more the essence of the Anglo-Saxon being crosses over into savagery. This savagery definitely exists, and it is once again based on the fact that the economic question is actually not a part of the discussion. In the East, the collective social structure, due to the particular situation that I described to you, becomes absolutist. In the West, it becomes anarchistic. Just take a look at what happened in the West. People were banking on the inexhaustibility of economic life. They were simply feeding off the colonies. They were working on the basis of this inexhaustibility without thinking through this economic life. The Western economic life was absolutely built on the principle of taking as much as possible from the colonies, regardless of whether the colonies lie within or without. It is quite telling, if you follow the way, that during the 1880s and the 1890s, more and more territories were gained in America for the purpose of growing wheat and other crops. People took from the natural world. It was not particularly necessary for them to think about economic life. Consequently, it made no difference to them what it meant to have associations in economic life, because the economic life there operated on the basis of inexhaustibility. But all the same, something happened. An economic structure was formed. England's structure is based on the fact that it controls India. In America, a certain kind of economic life was formed. This in turn impressed its structure onto all of the West's social life. Something came into being that has led to a way of conducting economic affairs arising only from the principle of inexhaustibility. In the East, the decadent social life that pays no regard to economic life tends toward absolute dominance in all areas of social life. In the West, what I have just described to you developed out of the Anglo-Saxon's ability to assimilate. In this opposition between East and West, modern civilization was erected. It is interesting, for example, to compare two completely opposite people with one another. Rodbertus, the German national economist, who, despite being a fairly open-minded man, could one day end up in the ministry, which many people are claiming, and, let us say, Karl Marx. A person like Karl Marx was possible only because he first learned to think in Central Europe and afterward witnessed economic affairs in the West. Karl Marx could never have achieved what he has achieved for the proletariat if he had never spent time in Germany. All of that came about only because he learned to think in Germany, then became familiar with the way people conduct themselves on a daily basis in France, in Paris, and then became familiar with the economic life in England, based on the principle of inexhaustibility and all that comes with it. And it was upon this final piece that he could begin to build his work. In the same way, it is characteristic of Rodbertus, this is why we are comparing here two people, Rodbertus and Karl Marx, that he assessed things like, and this is of course an exceptional case, like a Pomeranian manor house lord who had suddenly become socialist. This was how he looked at things, and it is interesting. For when you take a look at two extremes, like Rodbertus and Karl Marx, much of interest comes out of it. But Rodbertus must be understood thus, as a suddenly socialist Pomeranian manor house lord. Such a person knows well that one can never fully dispense with agriculture. He knows what significance it has for the national economy. Others say all sorts of nonsense that is pleasing to those who in their youth did not learn to tell the difference between barley and wheat because they grew up in the city. But a man like Rodbertus knows better. A man like that knows the significance of agriculture being overstressed by mortgages. If he still has any socialistic pretensions, as he once did, then he does not allow the one to contaminate the other very much. Something questionable does indeed come to the fore, but one side corrects the other. And the result is something halfway brilliant, revealed in the person of Rodbertus. And so, compare this with what Karl Marx said, and you will say to yourself, quote, the members of the proletariat today, in the broadest sense of the word, find that what Karl Marx said is immediately clear to them. Close quote. Why do they find it so? Because it was thought of in the context of a purely economic life, and the proletariat find themselves solely within economic life, and also because it is particularly astute thinking, since Karl Marx learned to think in Germany. But a German could not form any concept of the way that economic life would be if everything was thought of only economically. Germans today cannot do it either. A contemporary German would do this only by saying, quote, I must create a reality in which it is possible to think purely in terms of economics. Close quote. This is found within the threefold social organism. Everything else that appears in the West, take Darwinism or men like Spencer, Huxley or one of the American scientists, or even Emerson, Whitman and the others, all of it in the spiritual life has a fundamental quality that leads us to say, quote, the thinking head begins in the stomach, close quote. Everything is a transformed, transplanted instinct. Everything is actually just thought of as economics. They think only through what they eat and drink. This is the case all over, and to a very high degree. Certainly a lot of people do not notice it these days, and if you say this, then they take it as an insult. But it is not meant as an insult. It is, in fact, something of great significance. It is the only thing of great significance in recent, in contemporary civilization, this way of thinking. But it is the case. And European civilization has in fact been squeezed between these two extremes since the 18th century. Only the people that have been excluded from European civilization, that have simply been put in front of machines, only these people have brought to the world a way of thinking on the surface level of things that would seem to have nothing to do with these same concerns, but that in fact has everything to do with them. This is the world of the proletariat. And it is most interesting when you consider these things as they really are. Austria, as I have already said, was the experimental country. In the 1870s and 1880s, very strange things happened in the life of the Austrian nation. On one side, there was much discussion about the Slavic question. Some called it more accurately, quote, Austrian federalism, close quote. The entire spiritual life in Austria, spiritual life being one branch of the threefold social organism, was given its structure entirely on the basis of these discussions about the Slavic question. On the other side, terrible fruits were born. You will find this in the subordinate clauses of the parliamentarians' speeches, much more than would seem to be correct or necessary. Terrible fruits were born out of the collapse of Austrian economic life under Americanism, under Anglo-Saxon economics. You can see everywhere in Austria the way in which their exports, for example their exports of grains to Hungary, were infringed upon by what came from the West. Back then, very insightful people in Austria said, quote, the flow from west to east will flood our country with debts. Agriculture will gradually die out, close quote. This was in turn a hint at symptoms that bespoke deep historical causes, so that at the time in Austria there was a lot of talk about what, in regard to spirit, was shining through as the Slavic question, and what, in regard to economics, was shining through in the question of agriculture. And then, for example, a strange plan turned up in the heads of a few people, I think it was around 1880, that will actually make quite an impression on you. It was even discussed in the Austrian Parliament. A plan for a League of Nations was put forward, or in any case a plan that called for a League of Nations that would actually have to be referred to as a League of Western European Nations. But leagues that actually incorporate the whole world cannot actually be formed in this way. That is nonsense. It could only come about in the head of an abstract man such as Woodrow Wilson, that one would form a league that incorporated the whole world. If that were possible, then you would, of course, no longer need such a league. So, anyway, the idea for a League of Nations had already turned up in the 1880s. Again, you can see here something about which you can then say, quote, in the course of the 19th century, impulses periodically appeared that were actually needed, but they were always overrun by the impractical solutions that were always brought forward without any regard for their historical reality. Close quote. Wherever reality has shone through into human realities, it has always been immediately obliterated. For the contemporary human being is a theoretician. And this is the idea that I would most like to entrust to you. If you all do not succeed in casting off your theoretical selves before you set out on your work, then you will achieve nothing. You must set aside the theoretical self. You must attempt to speak out of reality. Your work will sometimes succeed, sometimes not. That part does not matter. What matters is that you speak on a foundation of reality. To that end, it was not my intent to present you with judgments today, but rather to point out to you the facts. I said to you, consider what has come about as a result of the Treaty of Neustadt in 1721 and the Treaty of Paris in 1763. Everything that is historically described about these events is yours to consider. You have a perspective to look at. Everywhere you will find things from these events that continue to play a role in the spiritual life, the right's political life, and the economic life. I wanted only to illuminate one aspect of this. For if you let your words come out of your own judgments of the matter, then you will achieve something. If you only repeat what you have heard, you will not. The end of Lecture 2.